Good evening. The debate about cloning has been reopened. A controversial sect claims to have produced the world's first human clone, but there's no proof yet, and many scientists are skeptical. North Korea is expelling inspectors who've been monitoring its nuclear program. Two bomb explosions in the Chechen capital Grozny have killed at least 40 people. At home, police are planning to hold a national firearms amnesty. New figures on Christmas shopping confirm that sales have been disappointing. A religious sect has claimed it's cloned the first human baby and has said it will provide proof within the next fortnight. The group said the baby girl, called Eve, was born yesterday to a 31-year-old American woman. However, at the moment, there's been no independent evidence that the breakthrough has taken place, and the news has been greeted with deep skepticism by many in the scientific community. The company behind the announcement, Clonaid, is funded by a religious sect called the Raelians, who believe that mankind was created by extraterrestrials. Our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh, has been investigating the claim.
Although the claim has been roundly dismissed by many in the scientific community, the announcement is creating headlines across the world because some think it is now at least theoretically possible to clone a human being. Since the creation of Dolly the sheep more than 6 years ago, the cloning of animals has now become routine. There are now hundreds of cloned cattle, sheep, mice, and more recently a cat. Although the scientist that has made the claim, Brigitte Boisselier, is linked with a cult that believes that human beings were created by aliens 25,000 years ago, the organisation has the will and possibly the financial resources to try such an experiment. And at a press conference in Hollywood, Dr. Boisselier claimed that her team of scientists had succeeded in creating the world's first cloned human being.
It's very important to remember that we're talking about a baby. The baby is very healthy, she's doing fine, the parents are happy, and I hope that you remember them when you talk about this baby. Not like a monster, like some results of something that is disgusting. She's a very healthy baby.
Scientists, though, are skeptical because cloning is still a difficult process. It took hundreds of attempts to create Dolly, with many miscarriages and deformed births on the way. Dr. Boisselier has no known expertise in the technology, and even the leading experts in the field still haven't categorically demonstrated that they've created a cloned human embryo. Susie Leather, chair of the UK's Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, was among many today who said they doubted Dr. Boisselier's claim.
You could be forgiven for regarding this act both in its timing at Christmas and in naming the baby Eve as a particularly cynical publicity stunt. I think in reality, if it has indeed happened, it's actually a profoundly misguided and highly irresponsible scientific experiment.
Dr. Boisselier has yet to provide proof that she's created a clone baby. At the very least, that would require an independently verified DNA test showing that the alleged mother and clone baby are genetically identical.
The crisis surrounding North Korea's nuclear activities is deepening. The government in Pyongyang is to expel two United Nations inspectors who have been monitoring its nuclear facilities for the past 8 years. North Korea has already decided to restart a nuclear reactor whose use has been banned since 1994 and is also now threatening to start up an atomic reprocessing plant which could be used to make weapons-grade plutonium. Our correspondent Charles Scanlon has been following developments.
For weeks, North Korea has been raising the stakes in the confrontation over its nuclear program. Now it's threatening to provoke a full-blown security crisis. It's ordered the expulsion of international inspectors from the nuclear complex at Yongbyon. The International Atomic Energy Agency has been monitoring the facilities since they were frozen 8 years ago. North Korea has also threatened to reopen a reprocessing laboratory that could produce plutonium for nuclear warheads. That would be seen as a direct challenge to the United States, which contemplated airstrikes against the plant during the last crisis in 1994. North Korea has accused the United States of planning to disarm it as a prelude to toppling the regime. It's been demanding negotiations and the signing of a non-aggression pact. But Washington says North Korea must give up its nuclear ambitions first.
The United Nations is urging the North Koreans to reverse their decision. The head of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed Al-Baradi, said the inspector's departure would move the world further away from defusing the crisis. Here, the Foreign Office Minister Bill Rammel told the World at One he hoped a diplomatic solution could still be found.
The situation is concerning. What I think is positive, however, is that there is virtual unanimity within the international community, China, Russia, the United States, ourselves, other European countries, all saying the same thing to the North Koreans, that what they're doing is unacceptable and they have to get back into compliance.
UN weapons inspectors say an Iraqi scientist in Baghdad has given details of a military project that has attracted attention as a possible prelude to a clandestine nuclear program. Earlier, a spokesman for the inspectors told BBC News they were preparing to question another scientist outside the country. Our correspondent Caroline Hawley sent this report from neighbouring Jordan.
UN weapons inspectors are pressing ahead with their sensitive but crucial mission. Today, as well as visiting a brewery, they interviewed a key Iraqi scientist. The UN spokesman in Baghdad said his answers would be of great use to the International Atomic Energy Agency. But UN attempts to begin questioning Iraqi scientists outside Iraq appear to have run into difficulty. The UN spokesman in Baghdad, who earlier said the first interview would take place soon, now said he was less optimistic, that it would take time to organise. He gave no reason, but Baghdad is fiercely opposed to the UN's new powers to fly scientists abroad, which the Americans are pushing the inspectors to use.
The authorities in Chechnya believe 40 people have been killed and as many injured in a bomb attack which devastated the offices of the pro-Russian government. Suicide bombers drove two vehicles through security barriers surrounding the building. We've had this report from our Moscow correspondent, Steve Rosenberg.
At government headquarters in the Chechen capital, Grozny, employees were returning to their desks after the lunch break when suddenly their world was blown apart. Two massive explosions tore the building to pieces. Moments before, a lorry and a car packed with explosives had been driven into the compound with devastating results. Dozens were killed in the powerful blast, many more injured, buried under mountains of rubble. It's the bloodiest suicide bomb attack ever in Russia. As night set in, rescue workers continued to search the debris for survivors and to recover the dead. Chechen rebels have already claimed responsibility for the attack via their website. Following the explosion, security has been stepped up across the country and especially in Moscow.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Ruud Lubbers, has reopened the debate on how many asylum seekers are coming to the UK. Mr. Lubbers said Britain was taking more than its share of would-be immigrants, but refugee groups have cast doubt on his claim. Our correspondent, Jane Peel, has been studying the figures.
The United Kingdom has more asylum applications than any other country in Western Europe, 21% of all claims. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says the UK is a popular location and is taking more than its fair share of asylum seekers. Ruud Lubbers told the Today programme countries should take one refugee per thousand in the population.
The UK is a country, because it's so attractive, that get more than proportional. So if we can come to an international understanding, for example, in the European Union with 350 million, let's share the burden so that we have less in the UK and you'll find more spread over the European Union.
Some refugee groups say the comments are misleading. In total, the UK takes less than 2% of the world's refugees. Most are accommodated in developing countries. And when the numbers in the population are taken into account, the UK is a long way down the league. The chief executive of the Immigration Advisory Service, Keith Best, says it's an international problem requiring an international solution.
Actually, if you look at the number that we take as a per head of the population in Europe as a whole, we're about ninth or tenth in the league. The people coming here are coming for a variety of different reasons. Many of them now, because of the border controls, don't have actually much choice about their final destination. They put themselves into the hands of the people smugglers, and then they find themselves in Britain.
The Conservatives say the asylum system is in administrative chaos and is failing to identify genuine refugees. They're calling for new accommodation centres, capable of processing people in weeks rather than months.
An inquiry has begun into the death of an 86-year-old woman who'd developed high levels of insulin in her body. Ethel Hall, a retired shopkeeper, died in Leeds General Infirmary earlier this month, 5 days after officials called in the police following a routine hip operation. Detectives say a 26-year-old man, who's believed to be a member of the hospital's medical staff, has been released on bail pending further inquiries. Police in Belfast are hunting a gunman who shot dead, a 22-year-old man, in his home in the north of the city this morning. Security sources are linking the murder to a feud within the Ulster Defence Association, although the man's family say he wasn't involved with any paramilitary organisation. Police throughout England and Wales are planning a firearms amnesty in the new year in an attempt to tackle the growing problem of gun crime. It's also expected that there will be tougher new laws against illegal weapons and that a national database of guns will be drawn up. Our crime correspondent, Neil Bennett, reports.
Figures to be published next month will show that a record number of offences involving firearms are being committed. Many involve replica guns which have been converted and which are used to settle disputes between rival drug dealers. So serious is the situation in some of Britain's cities that chief constables want a three-month amnesty early next year, similar to those which followed the Hungerford shootings in 1987 and the Dunblane massacre 6 years ago. More than 60,000 weapons were handed in. The Home Office is also considering a minimum five-year sentence for anyone caught possessing a gun and setting up a national database and a new agency to trace illegally held weapons.
Polling stations in Kenya have been closing at the end of a relatively peaceful election day that will see President Daniel Arap Moi step down after 24 years in power. The candidate of the ruling KANU party, Uhuru Kenyatta, is facing a strong challenge from Mwai Kibaki, who's leading the National Rainbow Coalition of opposition parties. Initial figures from retailers suggest that high street trading in the run-up to Christmas was disappointing. The reports published today suggest that takings were no higher, or in some cases lower, than at the same time last year. Here's our business correspondent, Hugh Pym.
These are preliminary reports on the Christmas shopping season. More detailed trading statements from the major high street players will be made early in the new year. But, added to other evidence earlier this week, it's becoming clear that this wasn't a bumper festive season in the shops. The footfall index, which counts shoppers at leading retail sites, said numbers were 11% lower on Christmas Eve compared to last year, although they were higher on Boxing Day when the sales began. Withdrawals from Barclays cash machines over the last few weeks were down slightly. The jeweller's Goldsmith said turnover was no better than last year and talked of a tough retail environment. And at the store chain John Lewis, Gareth Thomas described the last few weeks as good but not great.
We would have preferred to have hit much bigger percentage increases as we got closer to Christmas. It just didn't happen that way, and we're content with what we've managed to achieve, but it could have been better.
Only the photographic retailer Jessop seemed to have bucked the trend with a 10% sales increase. There are signs then that shoppers tightened their belts before Christmas, although they piled in as usual to the sales today. Concerns about the economic outlook and issues like pensions may be beginning to take their toll.
In the city, the 100 share index closed down 113 points at 38.29. On the currency markets, the pound was up slightly against the dollar at $1.60. Against the euro, sterling fell slightly to €1.53.8. On Wall Street a short time ago, the Dow Jones was down 70 at 83.63. England cricket supporters who are in Australia for the Ashes tour have been criticised for their rowdy behaviour on the second day of the fourth test in Melbourne. The Australian opening batsman, Justin Langer, who'd earlier made 250, described the so-called Barmy Army as a disgrace for shouting no ball every time the fast bowler Brett Lee ran up to the wicket. But whatever their fans' tactics, England still face a monumental task to avoid a fourth successive defeat in the series. By close of play, they'd slipped to 97 for three in reply to Australia's 551 for six declared. The Chelsea goalkeeper, Mark Bosnich, has been charged with breaching the Football Association's doping regulations and bringing the game into disrepute. Bosnich tested positive for cocaine last month. The singer and songwriter Jake Thackeray has died at the age of 63. Jake Thackeray, who was born in Yorkshire, made a succession of best-selling albums during the 1960s and 70s with quirky tracks such as Family Tree, The Castleford Ladies' Magic Circle and Bantam Cock. His television appearances included The David Frost Show, The Braden Beat and That's Life. Here he entertains an audience with a song called The Bull.
Oh, my father, the bull is the king of the yard. He's big and bad and fast, he's strong, he's hard. All my other animals would regularly concur, but he is the one you salute, he's the one you call sir.
Singer Jake Thackeray has died at the age of 63. The headlines again. Leading scientists have cast doubt on claims by a religious sect that it's cloned the first human baby. North Korea is expelling two United Nations weapons inspectors who've been monitoring its nuclear program. At least 40 people have been killed by two bomb explosions in the Chechen capital, Grozny. Police in England and Wales are to hold a firearms amnesty in the new year. New retail figures have confirmed that sales in the run-up to Christmas were disappointing. BBC Radio 4 News.
Today we'll be hearing live from Kenya, where voting is underway in presidential and parliamentary elections, which hold out the prospect of the most dramatic shift in power for a quarter of a century.
Also, we'll be continuing our tour of southern Africa, mapping the contours of an emerging famine.
And with the Turkish Security Council about to vote on allowing the Americans to use military bases against Iraq, we hear of local opposition to the idea.
U.S. doesn't have any right to insist anything upon Turkey. In the last war, Turkey suffered a loss. Approximately $50 billion.
First here on The World Today. First though, the world news.
BBC News with Roger Dentith. Voting is taking place in landmark presidential and general elections in Kenya. Five candidates are vying to replace President Daniel Arap Moi, who is constitutionally barred from a further term. There has never been a democratic handover from one president to another in Kenyan history. Ishbel Matheson reports from the rural constituency of Gatundu, near Nairobi.
At daybreak, Kenyans started to queue at polling stations, eager to cast their votes. People here are in no doubt about the importance of this election. It's the end of an era. Kenya's veteran leader, Daniel Arap Moi, is stepping down after nearly a quarter of a century in power. The ruling party candidate is Uhuru Kenyatta, the son of Kenya's independence leader. As he cast his vote, he said he was confident of victory. Under his leadership, he said, Kenya would have a fresh start. But before the polls opened, most reports suggested the 71-year-old opposition leader Mwai Kibaki was poised to win. Many Kenyans think Kibaki, a former finance minister, is the man to turn around the country's ailing economy.
The president-elect of South Korea, Noh Moo-hyun, has made what's being seen as his strongest call yet for North Korea to reverse moves to restart a nuclear reactor, which could produce weapons-grade plutonium. Mr. Noh said Pyongyang was defying the international community's wishes for an end to nuclear proliferation. Kevin Kim reports from Seoul.
President-elect Noh Moo-hyun, who has supported the need for exchanges and dialogue up to now, condemned the North for its nuclear maneuvers. He said that there could be no reason for the Pyongyang government taking such actions. It was not beneficial for the peace in Northeast Asia, he said, nor was it helpful for North Korea's own safety. Since Wednesday, North Korea has moved as many as 1,000 fuel rods to its 5-megawatt reactor in Yongbyon, north of the capital Pyongyang. This reactor was closed after North Korea reached an agreement with the United States in 1994 to shut down its nuclear facilities.
The authorities in China say they have closed more than 3,300 internet cafes in the past 6 months. The official Chinese news agency said the closures were a safety measure, prompted by the deaths in June of 25 people in a fire at an internet cafe in Beijing. Critics of the Chinese government have accused it of using the safety issue as an excuse to impose tighter controls. You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. Turkish members of parliament have voted to change the constitution so that the head of the governing party, who's banned from sitting in parliament, can run for office. The leader of the Justice and Development Party, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, was prevented from taking part in November's general election because of a conviction for inciting religious hatred. Johnny Diamond reports from Istanbul.
The ball is back in the president's court. President Sezer vetoed these amendments last week because they were, he said, subjective and personal. That is to say, they were aimed entirely at getting Recep Tayyip Erdogan into parliament. The constitution bars those from parliament who have been convicted of what are called ideological crimes. In Mr. Erdogan's case, a conviction for inciting religious hatred. When his party came to power in late November, it set about changing the constitution so that Mr. Erdogan could stand. In this, it has had the opposition's support. Now President Sezer has a choice. He can accept the unchanged amendments, refer them to the constitutional court, or call a referendum on the changes.
The Polish government is due to officially announce today who has won a $3.5 billion contract to provide the National Air Force with fighter aircraft. The French company Dassault has already said it thinks a rival bid from the American firm Lockheed Martin has been accepted. The chief executive of Dassault said he thought the Poles had chosen the American firm's bid for political reasons, because they want to foster closer relationships with the US government. The government of Lesotho has said the country is fighting its biggest ever challenge, the double tragedy of hunger and HIV/AIDS. More than 31% of the population of Lesotho is thought to be HIV positive, one of the highest figures in the world. Thousands of anti-government strikers across Venezuela have renewed their protests as the crippled oil-producing country prepares to receive its first shipment of imported petrol. Venezuela is the world's fifth biggest oil exporter, but a strike lasting for nearly a month has drastically cut production, resulting in fuel and food shortages. In the worst-hit areas, some drivers spent the festive season in their cars queuing for petrol. Opposition leaders have criticized Brazil for sending the shipment of 500,000 barrels, 4 days' supply, which is due to arrive on Saturday. BBC News.
Six minutes past six. This is The World Today from the BBC World Service with Linda Duffin and Max Pearson.
The Kenyan election is now well underway. More than 10 million people are registered to vote. Daniel Arap Moi, one of the great survivors of African politics, is stepping down after 24 years in power. His successor will either be Uhuru Kenyatta from the governing KANU party or the veteran opposition leader Mwai Kibaki. The World Today's Kevin Hamilton is in Nairobi and he joins us now live from there. Good morning again, Kevin.
Good morning, Max. We're in the Langata constituency at a polling booth here. It's one of Nairobi's poorest areas, but that certainly hasn't stopped the crowds from turning out in their thousands. The problem, and it appears early, is that the lines are moving incredibly slowly. People are standing patiently as I speak to you, but of course the concern is that later on in the day, when it gets towards the time that the polling booths close, the tempers might become a little bit frayed. Now, I've been talking to some of those who've been waiting to vote. How long have you been waiting?
5 years.
5 years you've been waiting to vote.
Yeah.
So your vote is very important for you.
Me. It's very important to me.
And what changes do you hope will happen in Kenya?
What change I need is to change the government.
How long have you been waiting?
From 5:30.
But it's been worth it?
Yeah.
And may I ask who you're going to vote for, or is it a secret?
That is a secret.
I'm going to vote for the candidate I prefer. I know him. I know my preferred MP. I know my preferred civic candidate.
You're becoming a little impatient about waiting so long.
Yeah, since 6 o'clock I was just lining up. And the station was open at 7 o'clock.
What is the problem?
The main problem is this, that we have got a clerk who takes about 20 minutes only to check one voter. How long are they going to take for about 1,000 voters?
Well, a problem there, but we have talked to the Electoral Commission, who assure us that if there are still people waiting to vote when the polls close at 6 o'clock tonight, then the polling stations may well stay open. Now, with me to talk about this problem and the rest of the election is Mutahi Nguni. He's a research scientist with the organization Consult Africa. Now, Mutahi, does the fact that the lines here are moving so slowly concern you?
Yeah, this is a major source of worry for me, because it could be a form of rigging. Possibilities are that the officers in there are probably doing a go slow. And so long as they go slow, possibilities are some people might be sent away without voting.
Now, just so I'm sure, this is a NARC stronghold, and you would suspect that some of the clerks who are handling the voting are not NARC supporters?
Absolutely. I think this also being a NARC stronghold, this could be a government ploy to ensure that they do not vote. It's a form of rigging, in my view.
If we can turn now to the election as a whole, the turnout here is vast. Do you expect that kind of turnout will be reflected across the country?
Yes, we are actually anticipating close to an 80% turnout. And we are likely to have a very large turnout, especially in the rural areas, as opposed to the urban areas.
And coming back quickly to corruption, is corruption likely to occur in the cities more than in the rural areas, or is there a possibility of corruption anywhere?
I think the corruption we are likely to see in this election is most likely going to happen in the rural areas, especially because people are poor, and because of poverty it's possible for you to buy their votes. And this has actually happened during the electioneering period. And I'll not even rule out the possibilities of buying out votes during this particular day. They do it in open daylight, and this is possible also.
Both parties?
The people who are basically buying the votes are KANU. We have not had any reports of NARC buying our votes, although that's also a possibility in some places, especially in the KANU strongholds.
Right. Rigging aside, what's your assessment of how this election's going to turn out?
I think possibilities are that Mwai Kibaki might just take this election. And it's more because this election is about ethnic alliances. And he has the biggest ethnic coalition so far. Uhuru Kenyatta does not have any. He's going into this all as a lone ranger. But Kibaki is going into it with a coalition of up to about five aspiring presidential candidates who opted to vote or to have him as their candidate. So essentially, he is most likely going to take the day.
And do you think his coalition will stick together if he wins, or are there potential problems there?
Absolutely. I think that the coalition is most likely going to disintegrate after the election, but that will depend very much on how they handle it. But chances are that it might disintegrate and then get reconstructed thereafter.
Mutahi Nguni, thank you very much. We'll be back later on in the day on the BBC World Service, but for now, back to the studio in London.
And that was The World Today's Kevin Hamilton, live from Nairobi. Don't forget you can keep up to date with the results of the Kenyan election either by staying tuned to the BBC World Service over the next 20 hours or so, or by checking out the website, which is bbcnews.com.
Turkey's National Security Council meets today, and it'll be discussing the issue that's hung over the government for months now, whether to allow the US to use Turkish facilities in the event of a war with Iraq. The Turkish public strongly opposes any campaign. Our Istanbul correspondent, Johnny Diamond, has been speaking to some supporters of the governing AK Party.
Turkey's new government faces a bone-crunching decision whether or not to allow US forces access to Turkey's facilities, air bases and ports. On top of the international and regional pressures, there's a political dimension. The Turkish people, and especially the new AK Party government supporters, are pretty hostile to the whole idea. To find out why, I have got together three AK Party supporters, Ömür Aybar, İlker Ayca and Mutlu Alkan.
İlker, let me put it to you that it's getting very late now. We are weeks away, if the analysts are to be believed, from war, and that it's time for Turkey to make that decision. What do you say to the government which you campaigned for, which you voted for?
I think the diplomatic solutions time is not ended, and we think that there's still time. War should be the last decision.
Everyone talks about Turkey's relationship with the United States and how important that is. Do you think that that is an important alliance? Is that something which the government should be thinking about a lot?
Of course, the American relationship is very important for our future and our today and our past. But I cannot say exactly to you, we will go to war just to be near to America.
Okay, I've not heard a single person in Turkey say that they support regime change, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, having a war here. Have you run into anybody who says to you, we support the US?
Actually, I did not. But there are some facts which we cannot deny. One of these facts is that, of course, we do support democracy and we would prefer our Iraqi brothers have those types of freedom. But if we just think of supporting the whole war system, we cannot find maybe support from the Turkish nation.
Do you think in your heart of hearts,
yes,
that when the US says to Turkey, we want the use of your bases, in the end, Turkey will have to give those bases?
US doesn't have any right to insist anything upon Turkey, first of all. And the second thing is, as a nation state, Turkish country also has some demands from US. I would like to remind you something that in the last war, which was made between Iraqi and the US, you have seen that Turkey suffered a loss. are lost, according to our bureaucrats in Ankara, approximately $50 billion.
We can say no, definitely.
And should it say no?
If it is necessary, we can say no. We have right to say no.
Mutlu, what do you think? Can Turkey realistically say no to the world's only superpower and its closest ally?
Can any other country say no? If some other countries say no, then we can also say no.
Johnny Diamond there speaking to ACT supporters. Well, in the event of a war, Washington reportedly wants permission to use air bases to deploy soldiers on Turkish soil and to move troops into northern Iraq via Turkey to open up a northern front. But Turkey, the only Muslim member of NATO, ended up millions of dollars out of pocket after the last Gulf War. So two top US officials have flown into the Turkish capital Ankara armed with a financial aid package to sweeten the pill. But given the concerns in Turkey, will the US be able to get what it wants? Anthony Cordesman is a Middle East security specialist at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
I'm not sure the US will get everything it wants any more than the Turks will, but I think a deal has already basically been struck on US use of the airbase at Incirlik, and it's already clear to Turkey that the United States strongly backs preserving the territorial integrity of Iraq. The issue of how much aid Turkey gets, I think, is certainly something that's still up for negotiation, and at least from most reports to date, Turkey has been much more reluctant to allow any basing of U.S. ground troops than to allow U.S. air operation.
After the last Gulf War, Turkey found itself considerably out of pocket. What does it stand to lose?
Well, Iraq is a major trading partner. A lot of Iraq's legal exports of oil go through Turkey. It gets pipeline fees for that. Frankly, a fair amount of its illegal exports, particularly refined product, go through Turkey by truck. There is a major smuggling industry through the Kurdish zone of Iraq. And in the past, Iraq has been a major trading partner, importing construction services, foodstuffs, and a whole wide variety of goods from Turkey. So Turkey's concern is that a new war would yet again interrupt the flow of its exports and trade, and that potentially it might create a climate where Turkey would again have to deal with American occupation or extended conflict, which would seriously disrupt Iraq's economy and greatly reduce the volume of trade.
What sort of financial inducements do you think Washington will offer?
Well, first, I think there will be either loan guarantees or direct grants. There will be forgiveness of at least some U.S. aid and probably agreements to handle the transfers of some of the military technology that Turkey wants.
That was Anthony Cordesman there from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
It's nearly 18 minutes past 6 GMT. This is the BBC World Service. The program is The World Today, and over the last several months, aid agencies and the UN have been warning repeatedly about an impending potential famine in southern Africa. More than 10 million people are said to be at risk of food shortages as a result of drought and mismanagement. Our correspondent Alistair Leithhead has been travelling through the region during this Christmas week to assess the situation as best he and we can. He's in Lesotho this morning, and he joins us now live from the capital, Maseru. Good morning to you, Alistair. First question, just explain where you are and what the food situation is in Lesotho.
Yes, good morning. Well, I'm on a hill, the highest hill overlooking the capital, Maseru, and also overlooking some of the countryside, the fields sweeping out towards the highlands of Lesotho, because this is a small, very, very mountainous country, as you know, completely surrounded by South Africa. Currently, the situation here is that a huge number of people, approximately 2.1 million, are in the population here, and about a huge percentage of those people are in desperate need of food aid. About 500,000 people are in need of food aid. In May of this year, the King Letsi III here declared it a national disaster, a state of famine, and started cranking up an appeal for international help, and also to channel some of the government's small resources into tackling the situation with the people here.
That was back in May, as you say, and this whole situation has been evolving over the back half of 2002. And in places like Lesotho and elsewhere in southern Africa, it's combined with the continuing ravages of AIDS and the spread of HIV. It must make the situation desperately difficult for the authorities trying to cope.
Yes, I think that's probably the key here in Lesotho, is the number of people who are HIV positive and how much of an impact that's having on the agricultural system, and of course combining with hunger. It's being seen very much as a double whammy, if you like. On the one hand, you've got people who are starving and short of food, but also the whole structures associated with coping with these situations has been taken away by AIDS. 31% of adults, well, people between 15 and 49, are infected, according to UNAIDS here. And essentially, that means that the whole structures of coping, when in the past there were situations like this, because drought is no stranger to this part of the world by any means. It just means now that those people who would be out perhaps working in the farms, they're not as many of them, so they can't put the production into it, but also this whole coping system, the whole idea of families. You're seeing a huge number of orphans. 15% of children under 18 have been orphaned by AIDS, the figures show us. So yes, a huge problem when you combine the two situations together.
And we've been following your reports clearly over the past week as you've been touring the region. Have you been able to sort of pull together in your own mind an assessment of the degree to which the warnings that we've been hearing from the aid agencies and the UN over the past several months do actually chime with the reality of the situation on the ground? I mean, what are we looking at in the months ahead?
Well, I think certainly in the months ahead, the next 2-3 months are going to be a really critical phase of this whole thing. It is going to be the worst of it, I would have thought, because we're reaching the stage where some crops are down, the rains have arrived to a certain extent, but even if they keep going all the way through as they should till around March, people aren't going to be able to harvest things until April or May at the earliest. And they don't have food now in any of these countries. This is the shortage now. So as long as food aid is being provided for them, then they're going to be okay. But they're living hand to mouth. And as soon as that aid's taken away, of course, that's when people will start to die. I think that the whole situation has been compounded by various situations within each country, but the overall pattern is that it's poverty that's been gathering over years. Year after year after year, things have been getting slightly worse and slightly worse, and all it takes is a situation like a serious drought that we've had in the growing season last year, and the whole thing has been thrown into crisis. It may look green and lush, and that's perhaps the most astonishing thing when you travel through these countries. It looks like things grow and things grow well, but people are struggling, and people are going to continue struggling in the new year.
A sad story to have to tell in this Christmas week. Alistair Leithhead, live from Lesotho. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to The World Today from the BBC. It's been an extraordinarily tough year to make money on the financial markets. Most of the world's main stock indices have fallen in value, leaving only a few lucky investors to count their profits. Duncan Bartlett of our business staff joins us now. Duncan, have you made any money on your investments this year?
Well, I wish I could say that I had, because I've met all the financial experts and I've talked to lots of chief executives and chief financial officers, and I heard lots of them being positive and saying 2002 was going to be okay at the beginning of the year. In fact, it didn't turn out to be a very good year at all. The American stock market really suffered. That was down 15% the Dow Jones index and 30% fall in the Nasdaq index. I suppose when you look at the aftermath of September the 11th and the big accountancy scandals in America, WorldCom and Enron, that shook American confidence in the stock market. And what happens in America tends to be infectious across the rest of the world as well.
So are things looking up for 2003?
Well, not particularly, because there's still a very uncertain climate. There's an uncertain geopolitical climate, as with some of the stories that we've been hearing about in this programme have underlined. Still tension between America and Iraq, a very unresolved situation there. Mounting tension between North Korea and South Korea, for example. And still a lot of uncertainty about whether American companies are going to make any money, which is really what the stock market is all about. Looks as though the retail sales figures in the run-up to Christmas in the United States were very disappointing. Companies like Walmart saying, sorry, we've had one of our worst Christmases for many, many years. Even internet retailers like Amazon have seen their shares marked down amid worries about what's been happening in terms of sales in the United States. And it's not much better in Europe. The London stock market's fallen for 3 years in a row now, and Japan recently saw its share prices fall to a 19-year low. There are bright spots, places like, for example, Pakistan. The market there is up 107% so far this year. But that's only a very small stock market when you compare it to these big giants in America, Japan and Europe.
So how do you make money in this climate?
Well, it doesn't look as though it's going to be very easy to make money out of shares, at least for the time being. I suppose you could play the lottery. This is something that Andrew Whittaker, who's a businessman in America, has just done. and he won. Of course, we never hear about the people who didn't win, but Andrew Whittaker won a huge amount of money, $315 million, in fact. And he turned up to collect the money at a press conference, dressed all in black, including a large, wide-brimmed Stetson cowboy hat. He claimed it was the first time in his life he'd ever had such luck.
I've had to work for everything that I've got. Nobody has ever given me... This is the first thing anybody's ever given me.
But actually, he has had some success in business already, and he's run three construction firms. Not that they're doing very well at the moment, probably because of the problems that we've been hearing about with the American economy. So his plan is to help out the staff who've recently lost their jobs.
I've had to work for everything that I've got. Nobody has ever given me... This is the first thing anybody's ever given me.
We did hear him play that before, but he did promise to help out the job of the people he's had to lay off. And in fact, furthermore than that, he's actually said that he's going to give 10% of that $315 million to not one, but three different churches he attends. Obviously, a keen churchgoer, although not very consistent where he worships. Still have plenty of money left over, though, even if he does pay the tax man and the churches 10%. He says that his plan is to spend it on a helicopter, but with $315 million, you could think he would probably be able to afford a whole fleet of helicopters.
With a few planes thrown in as well. Duncan, thank you very much. Duncan Bartlett there with all the business news.
Now, in Venezuela, there doesn't appear to be much Christmas cheer around. Thousands of supporters of the opposition have taken to the streets of Caracas again in a renewed bid to remove President Hugo Chavez from office. Many people have been on strike for weeks, including workers in the vital oil sector. The government has deployed troops to urge oil workers to resume pumping the country's main export. But the tankers still lie idle in many ports. Maria Soares of the BBC's Latin American service is in Venezuela, but she's not in the capital, she's out in the provinces. And I asked her if the shortages of fuel and oil which have been felt in Caracas are being felt elsewhere.
Yes, actually, I'm in Lara State, which is the third largest city in Venezuela, about 300 miles west of Caracas. And here things are a bit quieter than in Caracas, but the shortages of oil and food are being felt here in a more sort of worse fashion, so to speak. I mean, basically, it seems that all the efforts that the government is doing is to supply petrol and, you know, gas and food is for Caracas, the capital. And that's why here in the provinces the situation is being felt, as I say, much more worse.
But does that mean that people where you are opposed to the strikes which have caused the shortages of oil and fuel around the country? Or are they opposed to President Chavez and his policies which have led to this situation?
Well, as everywhere in the country, actually, there is a division in the Venezuelan society. So here in the provinces, there are, you know, people who do support President Chavez and people who don't. And those people who don't have taken to the streets today to actually resume their protests and their demonstrations after the Christmas pause.
What about the regional efforts which are being made to have an influence on this situation? We know that some countries surrounding Venezuela are offering to ship in oil supplies to keep the country going. Is that regarded by Venezuelans as a helpful measure or an attempt to interfere in their own internal affairs?
Well, concretely speaking about the Brazil's move to actually ship 520,000 barrels of gasoline to Venezuela this weekend, the opposition obviously is a bit, you know, angry about it, and they have considered and described the move as an unfriendly measure by the Brazilian government, and also as a desperate measure by President Chavez to actually try to counteract the effects of the strike. Basically, they're saying that Brazil's move also is an interference in Venezuela's internal affairs, so they're not really liking it.
And that was Mario Soares of the BBC's Latin American service, speaking from Venezuela. It's coming up to 6:30 GMT, and you are listening to the BBC World Service, broadcasting from London. Thank you.